Bless you. Bless you. I'm already going to cry. Hi, my name's Ricky, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi. I just want to first say thank you to the committee for inviting me to be here, and thank you to all the members of this convention for inviting me to come and be here with you tonight. I was talking to some people on the way down. I said everybody I've talked to from this group has been unbelievably warm and kind, and like my spirit just sinks right into that. And from the second I walked in, I just I've adored everyone I've met, and so it's a blessing for me to be here, and thank you so much. And I see some friends of mine that are here, which is so exciting. Actually, the second I walked in, I was like, yay! And I come down here a lot. I've been coming to Palm Springs since I was a brand newcomer, year after year after year after year for conventions. And so it means a lot to me to be in this room and be standing here with you tonight. So my sobriety date is April 21st of 2006. I've been sober a little over 18 years. And crazy. I was in a meeting the other night where they counted, right, 18 years, 3 months, and what is it now, 10 days or something. And I love that because those 10 days are really important. And my spiritual advisor was saying, he said, I put the 10 days first because if I didn't get those 10 days, the other years would be gone and I wouldn't be here. And I'm just grateful. I've obviously have grown up in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got sober really young, and I've been blessed to be loved and walked through sobriety by some of the most incredible people in the world. And whether I know you and you walk me through every day, or I show up at your convention and you're nice to me, and you're warm and you have a seat for me and you invite me to sit with you at dinner, every single one of you has played a part in me being here 18 years later. And it just, I got a little misty sitting in the chair because I thought about tiny little me, a brand newcomer with like so much hope and anxiety sort of paired together, driving down to Palm Springs to be a part of these conventions, you know? And thank God for the people that always made it safe for me and always made it okay. So this is gonna be the fun night, right? Who's ready to party? You guys ready? Yeah. We're going to party all weekend, but I'm here to get this party started, and we're going to have fun. So I'll tell you my story. Some of it's funny, some of it's sad, some of it's sad funny. So I come from a long line of alcoholics. I have my grandfather's big book that was passed down to my dad that was passed down to me. It's our family heirloom. I am not kidding. It's the only one we have. I know some of you nice people have like war medals in your family and stuff. Not the Maynards. We have a big book. And I am the current keeper of the family heirloom, and I'm very proud. It sits in a protective box in my apartment. And so here I am. And I watched alcoholism from a long age. Now, I'm from the South, not of California, but of the United States. And so I was born in Tennessee, and then I lived in Alabama and Arkansas before I came here. And so just all the way through the South. And people in Los Angeles, I don't have much of an accent anymore, but if we talk for about 5 minutes, it'll be back for the rest of the weekend. But I don't have one really anymore. And so people in AA in Los Angeles or just friends that have grown up with me, they are surprised when they find out I'm from the South. They're like, you are? I'm like, yeah. They're like, oh my God. I'm like, what? They say, were you a debutante? Right? And I love that question, right? Because I smile a lot, I have a lot of blonde hair, and 18 years later, you women of Alcoholics Anonymous have taught me to put on clothes and have manners. And so, you know, like to dress like a lady, that wasn't happening 18 years ago. And so that's really a credit to Alcoholics Anonymous when people ask me today if I was a debutante. And what I say is this, is no, honey, I was a hillbilly, we were poor. I didn't know anything about being a debutante in our family. So I'm from a very poor Southern family, and my dad had moved us to Tennessee, Alabama. And when we got to Arkansas, my parents had split up, and my dad had moved out to Los Angeles. And he was out here, and I was in this apartment, you know, in my little hillbilly house. And I was raised back then by my mom, and some of my first memories are 4, 5, and 6 years old. I would climb up on this little ladder. You may not be able to tell, but I'm very short, and I was back then. And I'd climb up on this little ladder, and I'd pull open the freezer, and I'd get these bottles out, and I would pour them down the drain. I didn't know what they were. I now know that they were vodka. But all I knew is that when they came out and my mom drank them, it made bad stuff happen. And I was a smart little kid, so I was like, remove the problem, right? Like, if I can just get rid of this stuff, then maybe we'll be okay. I now know that's a really mean thing to do to an alcoholic, but I wasn't really working with that ability at 5. Like, I just thought, let's just dump it. So I did that, and I can see myself in that kitchen, and I can, I pretty much hung out in the closet, which was later to be the same, but I would hang out in the closet because it was where I knew to be safe, and I would watch through the closet because my mom, she would fall asleep with cigarettes every night, and so I would wait for her to fall asleep so that I could put them out, so that she didn't burn down our one-bedroom apartment, and she had a lot of boyfriends that would beat her up, and I would just watch all this stuff through the cracks of the apartment, and I was, the cracks of the closet, and I was so scared, and I was so sad, and I just thought, why won't somebody help my mom? You know, I didn't know what could help her, but I just wanted somebody to help her, and I remember my sister and I crowding around this phone in the hallway in this little apartment trying to call my dad in California, and we didn't know how. And what I've always said, because it's all I knew, is that somehow my dad figured out what was going on. And I got more information on that. A few weeks ago, I took my dad out to breakfast, and I said, Dad, is it true that my sister and I came to Los Angeles to go to Disneyland and we never left? And because that's what I was told about how I made it to California. And he said, well, that's kind of true. I said, well, what happened? He said, you came out to go to Disneyland, but you were supposed to go back. And I said, well, what happened? He said, well, you told me what was going on. And I said, I did? You know, I had to be probably 5 or 6 years old at the time. He said, yeah, you pulled me aside in the hallway. And you said, Dad, would it be okay if I stay? Because we don't always eat and we don't always go to school. And there's some really stuff, scary stuff happening at our house back there. So would it be okay if we stayed here with you? And it makes me get choked up because I guess what happened next is that my dad called my mom in Arkansas. And he said, Angie, I think it would be better if the girls stayed here with me. And the part that really gets my heart is the love and the unselfishness of my mother. You know, because my mom, so I, you'll learn my story. I sought after education and all these things in the world. My mom didn't want any of that. All she wanted were these two little blonde babies that she had. We are everything she wanted in life. And if she could have chosen us, she would have. And when my dad said, Angie, I think it'd be better if they stayed here with us, she said, you know what, I think that's a good idea. Because she knew she couldn't protect us and take care of us. And that action and that love from my mother is the only reason I'm standing in front of you alive today, or that I went to school, or that I ate, or anything like that. And so, but I didn't know any of this as a little girl. I just thought I was staying and going to go to Disneyland, like, every day. And so, and I did. I moved into this big house in Burbank, California, and my mom would come out and visit, and I just watched her get sicker and sicker. When I was 11 years old, my mom died of cirrhosis of the liver. And so she was in the hospital, and the doctors told her if she didn't stop drinking, she was going to die, and she couldn't stop drinking. And what I want to tell you is that as an alcoholic woman, I completely understand. I know with everything in me, and so I'm the product today of really good sponsorship and really good therapy. Like, the only reason I have all my teeth. And, like, but one thing neither group has ever had to teach me, thank God, is that my mom wanted me more than anything in the world. And that this thing was a power greater than her, just as it was a power greater than me. And I watched all this happen, and when she died, I vowed that I was never, ever going to drink. I hated alcohol, and I became phobic of it. And when it would touch my hands, I would have to wash my hands, and I didn't want anything to do with it. And if you drank, I didn't really want to hang out with you either. And I set out to live this really big life that I felt like my mom didn't get to live. Nobody in my little hillbilly family had ever been to college, and I was like, that's not going to be me. I'm going to go to college, and I'm going to make this big life. Because as a little girl, when I would watch what was happening, I would watch my sweet mom, you know, and my mom never had education. She didn't work or anything like that. And I would just say, I'm never going to let that happen to me. I'm never going to let that happen to me. And I always felt like she was trapped, and something in my spirit knew what I would do to make sure that didn't happen. And I thought, if I set out and I get an education and a bank account, nobody can hit me and I'm not going to die. And so I set out to live this great big life. Now, let me ask you this. This is a big room, so I'm feeling good about these odds. Is anybody in here from a normal family? See, that is more than usual. That's great. And let me say this, you guys. There's a few, right? What I can tell you is this. One of my friends that I got sober with, she says the only thing wrong with her family is that she was in it. And it's absolutely true. I've grown up with her family in Alcoholics Anonymous. It is absolutely true. They're like June and Ward Cleaver. And somehow she came out. And so it's absolutely okay, right? But I'm not from a normal family. And so you can explain to me what it was like after the meeting. I wouldn't know one if it hit me on the head. And so this is a great example of my abnormal family. So my dad, let me tell you this too. My dad looks just like Rod Stewart. I know he's cute, right? But like, just like Rod Stewart, people that are my Facebook friends will attest to the fact that my dad is Rod Stewart in his mind. But he looks just like him. And so Rod Stewart goes to move me up to college. I went to college in San Francisco. And we go up to college and we're unpacking the stuff from the car on move-in day. And I don't know, you people from the normal families, you can tell me. I imagine in a normal family that you say something normal to your child when you're putting them into school, like, we'll see you at Thanksgiving, good job, kid, right? Like something normal, not Rod Stewart. Rod Stewart, like, looks super freaked out, and he just stares at me, and I was like, are you all right? And like, are you hungry? Like, are you okay? And he said, he just leans in really close, and he says, just run and don't look back. I was like, I think I went into shock, and I was like, what? He's like, just run and don't look back, just go. And I didn't think he meant don't ever come home. If he did, I violated that rule. I came home. But what he meant was just go and be somebody and be something. And we're not really sure how you escape the dumpster fire that is the alcoholism in our family, but just run as fast as you can. And I did. And so, and that was a really important moment, because I think before he even told me that, I spent my entire young life just running. Like, let me run as fast as I can to not be who I came from, or and not be a part of where I came from, and to go try to make something of myself. And I started to do very well. I was a straight A student in college. I was going to go to law school after college. I was tutoring everybody, the head of all these organizations on campus. Maybe it's the Southern in me, right? But we like to make everything look real nice on the outside, so that like you there's and the inside is like a freak show, but the outside looks beautiful. And so I put it all together. I always looked like, you know how a duck looks super peaceful gliding across the water, but underneath their feet are like this? That was me every single day of my life, just trying not to drown and trying to run away from where I came from. Or like the Indiana Jones movie with the big ball rolling behind him where he's just running. That was a Tuesday for me. Like, I didn't know you could live any other way. And so I ran. I'm in a sorority. I'm doing all this stuff. And junior year of college, I come home to Los Angeles for Christmas break, and I was out with my friends from high school, and I said, you know what? I think I'm going to drink tonight. Because for me, it wasn't like I was making some big decision, like, let's end my life, right? I was just like, I thought, because I had seen alcoholism so much in my life, but I didn't know what it was. And I thought that this was a question of willpower, right? And if it's a question of willpower, I've got it covered. Because don't you know who I am? I'm this kid, I go to this school, I get these grades, I'm gonna go to this law school. It couldn't, everything up until that point in my life that I had wanted to do, achieve, wrap my head around, I seemed to be able to exert enough willpower and hard work to get it done. And so it didn't occur to me that there would be something that would break me like that. Like, and call it the arrogance of being like 20 years old too. I just felt invincible, and it's gonna sound arrogant because I was. I thought, I'm sorry for you family that you couldn't handle this liquid in the bottle, but I'll be fine. And well, spoiler alert, I was wrong. I got back up to school, and I went from that half a drink to drunk every night almost immediately. Because for me, and now also, let's see the odds on this one. Who in here is a high-functioning alcoholic? There's some. You guys amaze me. I think it's so cool. Like, my dad, I admire you. My dad will tell you he's a high-functioning alcoholic, and it's absolutely true. When I was growing up, we had cars in the driveway, homes. He went to business trips and came back. Like, all of this behavior that I just don't understand, right? I might be gone to Bali for a few months if I left for a business trip. I don't really know. But I watched all this stuff, and that just wasn't my experience. Because when I found alcohol, it felt like it answered a question that had been burning inside of me my entire life. And it was all I wanted to do. And for the first time ever, I felt like every cell in my body just relaxed. And everything exhaled. And it finally, everything in my spirit made sense. And I was kind of mad. Because I thought, why didn't you guys tell me? Like, I know I saw you, like, be disastrous. But why didn't you guys tell me that this was going to be the thing that was going to make me feel okay in this world? Because I've been dying out here this whole time. And I just don't understand, like, why would you want to do anything else? And so I didn't. And my drinking looked like an after-school special. Do you guys remember those? Okay, if you didn't or you're too drunk to watch the television, what they were, there were these TV movies that were on when I got home from school. They're most like a Lifetime movie today for any of our YPAW people if they're not on TV anymore. They were these movies, and they were warnings of like what not to do, right? Oh, like little Mary only eats carrot sticks, and now she's in the hospital, right? I'm the one on alcoholism. It was like, sweet little Susie, sorority girl, tries alcohol. Cut to 6 months later, she's a crack whore. Right? like just the progression and the speed looked like an after-school special. Like, it was bad. Like, I'm a warning label. I'm that one that you show your children, and you're like, see what happens when you drink? You know? And that was it. I kept it together for a very short period of time. Within a couple months of my first drink, my sorority sisters that I lived with, they gathered in a circle in our living room and formed what looked like an intervention. But really it was you need to pack your bags and get out tonight. And I was like, whatever, right? What do I do with that? I think, okay, forget you, because I was so offended. I was like, that's rich. You guys drink too. And I don't need you anyway, you fake friends. I'm going to go pack my stuff and go, right? That's what my alcoholism says. I don't need you anyway. And so I pack all my little stuff and I go move in by myself. And I moved into the bathroom at my apartment because it was comfortable for me. Did anyone else get loaded in the bathroom? Okay, for the ones that didn't and the rest of you liars, here's why we did it. Sometimes when I'm in a white, when I speak at YPAW, the entire room raises their hands. I'm like, yeah. Because I was a kid and I wasn't rich enough to live by myself. And so I would go into this bathroom and I would lock the door. So that was helpful. Also, I don't remember windows in this bathroom in San Francisco, which was very helpful because I could light candles and I would set my mood lighting. And so it doesn't matter if it's day or night or if it's been 5 days, who cares? And I had a lot of feelings. And so I would play slow jams. That was my music of choice. And I would sing the slow jams into a wine bottle all day like this. And I would sing Boys to Men, End of the Road. I would just sing out all my little feelings. And this is how I spent my alcoholic career. And I'm sad to report to you that this is when alcohol was working for me. Like, it's as good as it got. I love the stories where people black out and wind up in like gorgeous tropical places. I wound up in the bathroom, like still. And so sometimes I would leave this bathroom sometimes I'd try to make it to class. That was very rare. Usually it was just to go down and get supplies. I was 21 units shy of a college degree and lying to everybody because I couldn't get it together to get myself like to class or to go anywhere to do anything, because I felt like when I found alcohol, I felt like I could breathe for the first time in my life. And then I needed it to breathe. And I couldn't leave. I couldn't leave it. And so sometimes I would go to get more supplies, and if you knew me at that time and you ran into me at school, you were alarmed, you know? And so I would run into people. I went to school at USF, right? So there's a huge staircase, and I would go down this giant staircase, and I would run into people, and they'd grab my arm. They'd say, hey, are you all right? And I was drunk, so I'd be like, I don't know what you're talking about. And they'd say, well, you used to tutor me and you used to shower. Are you okay? And I would say, oh, thank you so much for your concern. And I just keep going, right? Because I don't know, from a Southern family, you learn what to say. And and what I thought and probably said sometimes was, I'll stop when I want to, but that day's not today. You know, because I thought on one level, what my alcoholism would tell me is that I'll stop when I want to and that day's not today. I thought that I had that power. And I felt so right for doing what I was doing, because what I thought was, you know what, back off. You don't know me and you don't know where I've come from and you don't know what I've been through and what I've survived to be here. And if you did, you'd leave me alone. So just give me a break. And when I'm done, I will go back and do all these things that I'm supposed to do, but give me a minute, is what my alcoholism would say. What I felt inside is what our book talks about, which is that we often suspect that we're down for the count. And I'll never forget, I went to leave one day, and I sat down that big staircase, and if I had known it was graduation day, I would have never left. Because it was the day I was supposed to be graduating college, and this is everything. And when I say graduating college, you know, maybe you all are from families that, like, everyone went to college, and it's not that big of a deal, but in my family, it was the biggest deal. And everybody was proud of me, and my father, who is my hero, was telling everybody, my kid's in college, we're going to go to her graduation, she's going to go to law school, and all this stuff. And I had all of the pride and hope and joy of my family on my shoulders, and I was failing. And I knew. And so I sat down the staircase, and all these kids that I had tutored for 4 years were coming up the stairs in their caps and gowns, and my heart just broke. And I can still see myself, like it was yesterday, turning in slow motion and watching them go up the stairs. And I just thought, there goes my life. And there goes everything I was supposed to have. And my next thought was, I guess I am my mother's daughter. And what do I do with that? Right? Like, what do I do with those feelings? I didn't think, oh, that'll be me next year. In my darkest of dark, true moments, I knew I was done. And I just, I sat back down the stairs, and what I do with those feelings, when my heart breaks, when my dreams are crushed, when you tell me to stop calling, when you tell me you can't live here anymore, when you tell me my life is easier and safer without you in it, I can't watch you die, right? All of this stuff is happening to me so early on. Everyone's like, I love you, but I can't watch this, you know? And what do I do with those feelings is I pour more on to try to make it go away. Because if I can just get loaded enough, maybe I can breathe tonight, and maybe I can sleep, and maybe I can exist in this world. And this is all happening to me, and this is so early, so early on. And I get my stuff together, and I go move back home because I can't live at school anymore. And I go back, and I think on one level that I'm going to get it together and go back when I'm ready, and it just doesn't happen. You know, and my dad's heart is broken, and he's not really sure what's going on with his kid, and he doesn't know why I couldn't finish my last 21 units of my first college degree. And I make up some lies, and I carry on with my life, and I go start rolling around, and I'd get a little job, and I'd lose a job, and I'd do all this stuff. And so as I said before, my dad is my hero. He is my heart and my hero. So I live down the street from my dad today. He says I stalk him. Because I do. I have a convertible, and he has a balcony. I assure him that that's his fault. And so he says he's the captain of Moore Park Street in Studio City. He is. He stands on his balcony, and he talks to everybody. And And so I pull up in my convertible and I'm like, hey, Dad, what are you doing? And he goes, leave me alone, stalker. And I'm like, nope. And sometimes I call him because Moore Park is the street I live on too, and it's our main like driveway. And so I drive and I see his lights on at 11 o'clock and and I call him. I go, Dad, what are you doing up? He's like, you are so weird. And this is our relationship. He is just my heart. And my dad is my hero. You know, I told you what he did to save my sister and I, but that man worked his fingers to the bone every single night. My dad was in his office in our home working until 11, 12 o'clock every single night so that my sister and I never wanted for anything ever again. We may not have had clean clothes or gone to school early in our life, but he did everything he could to make sure that we never felt that. He gave us everything. And he is my love and my hero and my heart. You couldn't pay me all the money in the world to hurt that man. And it's the only thing I can do every single day. And this is the kind of kid that I am when I'm getting loaded. I leave my father up for weeks and months at a time calling jails and hospitals to find out if his kid is dead or alive because I'm not coming home, because I can't let him see me the way that I am. If that's not bad enough, they gave me a car to drive when I turned 16, and I leave it abandoned in parts of town with dust and tickets piling up on it so that the police or my father find it and he thinks that I've been kidnapped or maybe trafficked, and he doesn't know where his kid is again and again and again. And then after I don't have anywhere else to sleep, I slither into the back door of their house because they used to leave the door unlocked. And I would slither in and I would go to the room that they had for me, and eventually my dad would come and find me. And he'd start crying, and my dad is a very tough man, he doesn't cry. And he'd start crying and he'd say, I'm so glad you're home, and I'm so glad that you're okay. And I would look at him and I would say, I know, Dad, I'm so sorry, I promise I'll never do it again. And I meant it, right? Hook me up to a lie detector test and I mean it. Because if I had that power, there is no way I'd hurt that man. There's no way I would do that. There's no way I'd live the way that I was living before I got to come home. I mean, I would miss birthdays, holidays, all this kind of stuff, and I would come back home. And sometimes it was that night that I had to go, and sometimes it was a couple of weeks later, because I have the disease of alcoholism, and alcoholism demands treatment. I can either treat it with alcohol or I can treat it with the 12-step solution. I know nothing about a 12-step solution at this point. I'm treating it with alcohol. And so if I leave it untreated, I will go again. And that's what happens to me, you know, and that's my life in sobriety as well. I continuously treat my alcoholism because if I leave it untreated, I'm going to need to reach for the 12 steps in a more significant way, or I'm going to reach for a drink. It's just a matter of time. It's not one or the other. They told me when I got here, they said, honey, we're never standing still in sobriety. We're either sliding away from or we're walking back toward our next drink. Which one are you doing today? What do you want to do? And I didn't know any of this because I hadn't made it here yet. And I just keep going and I keep going. And this is the thing, for anybody who's new or doesn't know our book, it does a great job of outlining the disease of alcoholism, right? And it talks about this allergy of the body, which I talked about, which is like why there's this inexplainable reaction when I take it. But these moments where I would come home after I had been gone for months at a time and I didn't want to leave again, to me, that's the most cold part of this disease of alcoholism, is the obsession of the mind. Is that stone cold sober with nothing in my system, every single time I get loaded again, it's like I levitate out of my bed in the middle of the night and something pulls me and I'm gone again. Every single time, over and over and over again. And so whenever I stop, I can't stay stopped, and I don't want to hurt this man, but it's all I can do. I go and start staying on people's couches. Now, my clothing of choice at the time was a mini skirt, and I thought it was white, but if we saw pictures of it, I'm guessing it was gray, like the chairs you're sitting on, and I thought I looked so beautiful, and I would roll around the world in my gray mini skirt, and I would sleep on people's couches for months at a time. I was incredibly classy, so I had one of those pay-as-you-go cell phones, and I think somewhere around March of 2005, I think the Al-Anons got a hold of Rod Stewart. And here's how I know. Because he used to leave me messages on my pay-as-you-go cell phone, and the messages seemed to change in March of 2005. And he left me a message that said, when you're ready, we've set up a bed for you at a treatment center in North Hollywood. Click. It didn't say, come home for Thanksgiving, let me know if you need some money, are you alive? It basically said, if you don't want to die, we've arranged something for you. And I was like, that sounds nice. And so I was real hungry, and I was real tired, and I needed to wash my gray-white miniskirt. And so I was like, I guess I'll go back home. And so I went back, and I packed up all my stuff. But I was a little bit out of my mind. Like, I was probably bordering having a wet brain at this point. And I thought I was going back to school. Because it sounded like a dorm room, and I was like, I'd love to go to rehab. And so I packed my stuff like I would to go to school, and I get there, I pack my my pink suitcase and my college bedspread and my matching rug, and I went to rehab. And they put me in this room, my dorm room, and I go in, and I was like, fantastic. And so I start decorating, because that's what you do when you get to school. Like, and I thought I was at school, and they gave me a cork board. I love a cork board. And so I start pinning my sorority letters up on the wall, and I put my bedspread out, and I put my rug. And I was an orientation leader in college, so this is easy for me, right? Like, I can make friends, I can welcome you, and all these girls start coming by. And I wished I had cookies, right? And I'm like, welcome to my room, isn't it fun here? And they were like, and they all start... And they all start laughing, and I was like, right, it's fun. And they were like, I didn't know they were laughing at me, because most of them had just paroled from prison. And and they also gave me a nickname that I didn't know about. They named me Rehab Barbie. And they were like, what is wrong with this chick? And I was like, oh my God, I love my new friends. And but don't feel bad for me, because I wore them down. And if you don't like me tonight, don't worry, you will. I'll wear you down. Give me your phone number. It's just a matter of time, man. And so I wore these girls down. They became my homegirls. We played spades and charades, and we did rehab together. I don't remember much about your meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I was absolutely sure that you would elect me valedictorian soon, and I was going to get an A in AA. I would bring a notebook to your meetings, and I would take notes, because that's what you do in school. And so, it didn't occur to me that I wouldn't succeed here. And so I would take my little notes. They told me to get a sponsor. I'd call her from the payphone. Didn't really do anything she asked me to do, because I'm an extra credit student. And so I figured that it would just go very well. I was loaded at 58 days. And so that was May of 2005. From May of 2005 to April of 2006, what happened is that it got really, really bad. I'm from a family in Alcoholics Anonymous where we tear through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, line by line, word by word, page by page with a dictionary. We're those people. And one thing I've always looked up for myself and other people, but I've never had to, is pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I knew it as soon as I heard you guys read it when I got here, because it was every single day of my life before I walked in here. And the best way I can describe it in a general way is, how do you think a pretty little girl stays out on the streets for weeks and months at a time with places to sleep and things to eat and places to go? You know, this is just what happens, right? And I'm in all these places, and I'm with people I don't want to be with day after day after day after day, week after week after week. And I want to go home. I remember seeing those Ferrero Rocher commercials at Christmas, and I remember being in someone's house that I didn't want to be in. I was actually here in Palm Springs, and I was watching the Ferrero Rocher, and I just thought, I just want to go home for Christmas. Like, and I wish that I could be somebody else, and I wish that I could be different, and I wish I could be that girl I used to be, but I knew I couldn't, because every time I tried, I failed. And so I just kept living my life, and I was living in what our book calls the jumping off place, which is where I can't live with or without alcohol. And I don't want to be this way. And in April of 2006, somehow I made it back to my family's house somewhere after, like, you know, some interesting experiences around Christmas. And I made my way back, and I'm in the room at my dad's house. And I think that the Al-Anons got him again, because he came in. And if you're an Al-Anon, thank you, because you saved my life. He came in, and he said, honey, what are you going to do, because you can't do this? And it was just a matter of time before they told me I had to stop sleeping there because they started locking the back door of their house because I'm not safe to leave in your house alone at this point. This kid, the pride and joy of my family, you can't leave me unattended in your home because they're not really sure what's going to happen or what I'm going to do or if I'm going to be safe and alive when they get back. And I said, I guess I'll go back to that place. And he said, yeah, I think you're going to. And I packed up my stuff. The pink suitcase and bedspread were long gone at this point. And I packed up my stuff and I went back in there. And I'll never forget the hopelessness that was in my gut on April 21st of 2006. I was 23 years old, about to turn 24. And my dad actually reminds me of this sometimes just because it comes up in conversation. He just said it a couple days ago. He said, you know, you were about to die when you went in there. And I said, I know. Because I was probably weeks away from physically dying at 23 years old. And I had been emotionally and spiritually dead for a really long time. To the extent that I remember just staring up at this TV screen and everything inside of me was hollow. Like, it wasn't like I was having this big emotional response to what was going on. I was empty. And I did know one thing, and what I knew is that I didn't want to be here anymore. You know, a lot of people tell stories about being ready to die. One of my friends, who a lot of people know, tells this funny story about like putting on a white gown and laying down and like all this stuff, right? My moment was so quiet and it was so scary because I just stood there and I thought, just take me. Like, I don't want to be here anymore. Because every time I'm here and every day that I'm here, I have to live like I was telling you I was living or make my dad cry and leave my dad broken and scared. And so it'd just be better if I wasn't here. And that's all I brought you. I didn't come into Alcoholics Anonymous because I had any hope of living different. I didn't come in here like, yay, I'm going to get sober. This is going to be amazing. I came in here because I didn't have anywhere else to go. I didn't really have anywhere else to sleep for much longer. And I just showed up. And that's all you guys needed. You know, you took this scared, broken little girl and you welcomed me in. And I met women in this treatment center and they had been where I had been and their lives were different and better. And they said to me, the very most important thing that I'm going to say tonight, if you're new here with us, I beg you, if you've heard nothing else that I've said, please hear me. We have a way out if you want it, and it's outlined in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I used to go home and try to read that book by myself when I was new, and I would fall asleep every single night. So I'm a good joiner, you guys, right? And I kind of picked up pretty quickly that y'all had a book and you wanted me to read it. And so I was like, I know how to read. And so I got the book and I would go home and it sounded like this to me. 67 years ago, I was an alcoholic and I would pass out. Anybody, any newcomers that don't know the book, that's not a real quote. What it does say is war fever ran high and then it's New England time. Blah, 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 blah. And I would read it. And I was like, what is this? And I have a first-rate education. I'm going to promise you this. There are words in that book that are not in use anymore, like not for a long time. So don't feel dumb if you need to get a dictionary. I've sponsored hundreds of women over the years. There is one who didn't need a dictionary. I still had her look it up. But and she's like wicked smart. She just scored 99th percentile on the MCAT, so that'll tell you. Everybody else has needed a dictionary. And so I would go home and try to read it, and I would fall asleep. And I would go home and try to read it and fall asleep. So when I say, we have a way out if you want it, it's outlined in the big book. In my heart, in my experience, what I believe is that it took me pairing up with a trained sponsor that knew how to take me through that book and explain it to me. And she helped me find myself on every single page of that book. And I'm going to tell you about her. I didn't meet her till I was a couple years sober. And so I didn't know any of that. They just said, if you want a way out, and I was just like, okay. They said, if you want what we have, do what we do. I was 23 years old. I was like, I don't even know what that means, right? And they were like, well, honey, do you want what you have? And I said, no, ma'am. And they were like, okay, then just come and do what we do, sweetheart. And I was like, okay. And they said, also, I said, yes, ma'am. And they said, we tell the truth, honey, through the good, the bad, the indifferent. If you lie, you're going to get loaded. It's time you're going to start telling the truth now. That was a big ask. And I was like, okay, I can do that. And the lady, nice lady said, going to die. And so I go, and I go to a meeting, and I get my first sponsor. And I don't know, I read your steps. I knew you had a four-step. I wasn't quite, like, my wheels weren't really turning yet, but I knew they told me I was going to die if I didn't tell the truth. And so I got in the car with my first sponsor the first night she picked me up. And I said, excuse me, I have some things that I need to tell you. And she was like, okay. And I said, I told her all my secrets. I unloaded on this poor lady. I was like, okay, I've been doing this, 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 and this. I've been going here. I've been doing that. I lied. I did this. And I told her all my little stuff. And she just looks at me and she said, okay, honey, you never have to do that stuff ever again. And I was like, okay. And she goes, and you're going to be fine. I said, okay. And she said, and guess what? I said, what? She said, I did all that stuff too, and so did everybody at the meeting. You're with your people now. And I was like, okay. And she drove me to the meeting, and that woman walked me through my entire first couple years of sobriety. And I started showing up, and I got, they told me to get in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, so I did. They told me to pray, so I did. Now, as you can imagine, Rod Stewart did not raise me in the church. I believe that our family religion is the Rolling Stones. They weren't against it. He just wasn't the type of father that took me to church every week. And so I used to walk to Sunday school on my own as a little girl because I was always seeking something. And so I was excited to pray. I didn't really know how. I think that I picked up my religious knowledge from movies and television. So it was some sort of weird modgepodge of like Catholicism and I don't know what else. And you guys were really helpful to me. You gave me prayers that I was supposed to say, right? And so I would take these prayers home and I would get on my knees because you guys told me to do that. And I would say the serenity prayer and the third step prayer and the seventh step prayer. I wasn't really sure how to start or end. I saw this in the movie. So I would be like, in Jesus' name we pray, amen, break. And like I would go into my day. And I was really scared of like this God thing because I didn't know, I felt scared of it. I now know why, and I figured it out later. A lot of people throughout my life said something really well-meaning to me. And in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous as well, and I love it, and I think it's a beautiful thing, and I understand why people say it. They would say to me, you know what, honey, everything happens for a reason. And I'm a smart kid. And so I would go home and I would try to reconcile that. Because if everything happens for a reason, then why did your God kill my mom? And why do I have to be the kid that grows up without a mom? And why isn't there somebody there to zip my wedding dress or at my graduation? And I don't really understand why this God hates me so much that he picked me to live the life that I had lived up until this point. But I still want to be a part of this power's world. Like, I want to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not walking away, but I'm living with this fear, and I'm praying, and I'm like, excuse me, sir, would you please keep me sober today? Like, I don't know, and I'm terrified. And I go, and I say my little prayers, and I go, and I'm in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I get really busy. I was your secretary. I was your chip person. Unfortunately, I was some people's sponsor. I was like doing the best. I joke, I say unfortunately, it's actually very fortunately, it's an absolutely a good thing, but I didn't really know what I was doing. And I worked the steps with my first sponsor the best of my ability. I read my first inventory at 6 months sober. I'm not really sure what it said, but I read it, and because I did what I was supposed to do here. And I got very active. 1 year, 2 years, 1 foot in front of the other, 2.5 years sober, I'm sitting in the front row of Alcoholics Anonymous and I'm dying of alcoholism. I'm collecting resentments like their shoes. I know that my first sponsor probably told me to continue to take personal inventory. I wasn't listening, I was taking your inventory. And I was sitting in the meeting thinking, if this guy shares one more time, I swear to God, I'm gonna kill him. Like. And kill him. I would see his arm start to move and his hand about to go up, and I was like, just like I wish somebody would, right? Like that was my normal state. Restless, irritable, and discontent was my normal state, and I was losing my mind. I prayed. I would say your prayers, but I would hear you beautiful people in the meeting talk about having a conscious contact with a higher power, and I silently was terrified because I didn't know what that was. I said the things, and I was living in what I like to call now checkbox sobriety, right? I thought I was doing the things. I set the timer. I did the meditation. I said your prayers. I went to your meetings. I wrote stuff sometimes. And I was like, I didn't understand why I wasn't getting what you got. You said, if you want what we have, do what we do. I thought I was doing what you guys did, but I was dying. And I was just going through this life, and I mean, things were, obviously I was sober up until this point, something was working, but I felt like I was dying, and I was in this relationship that I had no business being in. People ask me a lot of times, why do I say that? Because I had no idea how to love myself, and so I have absolutely no idea how to love another human being, but I'm trying. And I'm living with this man, and I have years of abandonment issues, and all kinds of stuff, and sickness, and anger, and all sorts of stuff that needs to be unpacked in therapy and a lot of inventory that's never been touched, and I'm vomiting onto another human being. But I'm locking myself in the bathroom of our apartment, and I'm screaming. I'm literally screaming inside, and I'm screaming out loud because I'm so afraid this man's gonna leave because everybody in my life has left before, and the idea of being abandoned and being left is too much for me to handle, and this is me at 2.5 years sober. Secretary in your meeting. And I pulled, that gave me chills because it's freaking true. I work with a lot of people that are in that space, you know, because I come here, my brain isn't even firing and I work the 12 steps, right? But most people I've found hit like a second surrender at about 1.5, 2 years. And that was my experience. And luckily I told people what was going on because we tell the truth through the good, the bad, the indifferent. I am a perfect example of the fact that I don't have to drink to start over in Alcoholics Anonymous. I can start over at any time. In fact, my experience has been that's the entire thing, right? They told me things. You guys said some funny stuff when I got here. They said, more will be revealed. And I was like, is there a magic show later? Like, what is that? Okay, Merlin. Like, I was smart. And I was like, okay. And they said, it's like peeling the onion. And I was like, what? Do I have to cook? Like, I was so confused. I didn't understand, right? When you say that to a newcomer, it's bizarre. Newcomers, I'm sorry. I'm happy to decode any of the weird stuff we say to you. And so what they meant, though, is that I had to peel off different layers, and I was going to continue to grow and change. And, like, in my experience, it's the entire point around here. It's the entire point. I should be coming to the table regularly and learning and growing. I was actually thinking on the way down here, man, I'm so grateful it gets different so often. Like, I learn new things and I grow and I change in different ways all the time. I really believe I'm 18 years sober now. When I'm 25 years sober, I'm going to look back at 18 and be like, wow, so much has changed. Like, so much has changed in my spirit, in my sobriety, in my spiritual life, in all of it. And that's been my experience all the time. And sometimes those changes are not fun, or they haven't been. Now they're a little better. But that one at 2.5 years sober was the first time I had ever experienced it. So I think it's just commonplace, right? As children, we hear stories and we learn how a story goes. And as speakers, right, it's easy for me to get lost in the beginning, middle, and end, right? I was a train wreck when I was loaded, and then I got sober, and my life is rainbows, butterflies, and unicorns. Enjoy the chicken, right? Like, and that's true. My life is rainbows, butterflies, and unicorns, but there's a couple parts to that. My personal experience, if this isn't your experience and every day has been magic, I love that for you. That's just not been my experience. For me, there have been hills and valleys in sobriety. There have been many, many, most of the time when I feel like my life is rainbows and butterflies and unicorns. And then there have been times where I am wailing on the floor, needing to grow and change in new ways. And, you know, I also grew up in age in Alcoholics Anonymous and sobriety. So there was so much change going on at different times. But I've had huge emotional and spiritual rearrangements that at different times have not been super comfortable. You know, when character defects are changing, like when all sorts of stuff is going on, when I'm learning and growing, sometimes it hasn't been pretty and it's been really hard. The other part of this, of that, is that I can live in a palace full of gold and think it's bags of garbage if I'm not doing the work around here and my perception is off. my life is beautiful right now. My life was beautiful when I had a year sober. Man, we used to share a plate of French fries, and we had enough to, like, pay our little bills, and, you know, it was okay. And I remember just being okay with where I was. And if I'm in the right space spiritually, man, my life is rad. But I can, if I get off track and I'm not doing the work around here, I can be like, stupid job. The job that I prayed to God I would have, right? Like, the job that I was like, I'm not worthy, but I'm here, like, right? That job can be like, oh, blah, blah, right? Now, if my perception is off, and that's why I continue to do the work around here. I didn't know any of this when I got here, though. And I'm 2.5 years sober. I'm dying. And so I start telling people in hallways outside of meetings, old timers, I told them what was going on. I said, you know, I don't feel like people talk about feeling in the meetings. I don't know what a conscious contact is. And these beautiful, glorious women with time in Alcoholics Anonymous would talk about feeling comfortable in their own skin. And I, this little kid, would just look across the room at them and my jaw would drop to the floor because I have never known what that felt like. Because my heart would race when I would walk up to the meeting and my foot would tap in my chair and I was vibrating out of my skin at 2.5 years sober. But these women told me they felt comfortable in their own skin, and so I started asking questions. Some old timers told me that it might be good for me to go through the work again in a different way. And a sponsor was suggested to me. At 2.5 years sober, I sat down with Tanya for the first time and she had a rubber band holding her big book together. And our book talks about a man or a woman with a real answer. And there was something, I looked in this woman's eyes and I knew she had me. She just looked right back at me and I said, I asked her all my questions. I said, how do you get a conscious contact with a higher power? And how do I get comfortable in my own skin? And how do I stop screaming inside and screaming in the bathroom of my apartment because I'm pretty sure I'm not gonna make it? Like, I was losing it. I suspected it then. I know the book now, and I can promise you I was about to drink. What the book says about that moment that I was in was that I harbor resentment, I shut myself off from the sunlight of the spirit, the insanity returns, and I drink. It doesn't say I drink and the insanity returns. It says the insanity returns and then I drink. And not only had the insanity returned at this point, it had moved in and bought property. Like, it was the only thing here. I was only insane. And I asked this woman all this stuff, right? I said, how do you get all that? What is that? And she looked at me and she didn't even flinch. She said, you know how you got all that stuff, baby? And I said, how? She said, line by line, word by word, page by page. I'm going to take you through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when it says write, we're going to write. When it says pray, we're going to pray. And she said, you better get a God baby because I'm going to fail you. And it needs to be bigger than the one that you have now. And I was concerned when she said that. I said, you're going to fail me? Are you okay? Do you need a sponsor? And I did. And she said, no, baby. I'm a human power. I can't be your higher power, but I have really good news for you. I said, what's that? She said, my entire job as your sponsor is to introduce you to a power greater than yourself that can solve all your problems, and that's the main purpose of this book. That's what we're about to do. I said, okay. She said, something else? I said, yes, ma'am, because I'm from the South is what you say. And I said, yes, ma'am. She said, you need to pay attention, little girl. And I said, yes, ma'am. She said, because I'm teaching the teacher, I'm training the sponsor. If there's something in this book you don't understand, I need to know. Because you are going to spend the rest of your life teaching this book to other women, and it's going to save your life for the rest of your life, and it is going to change everything for you. Ooh. One of my favorite speakers is Bill C., and I think he's always said this perfectly. He said this since I was a newcomer. He says, I don't believe you have to give it away to keep it. I believe you have to give it away to even get it. And that has undoubtedly been my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't even start to crack the egg of, like, change for myself until I started taking other people through this book. With sponsorship, from that moment when this scared little 25-year-old girl sat across from this wonderful woman with a big book, today I sponsor women that sponsor women that sponsor women that sponsor women across the country. And I know there's, like, little pockets of people. And that's a thing, because she said, baby, Now when people ask you to sponsor them, you're not going to have to shudder anymore because you're going to have a big book and you're going to have a higher power. You don't have to question it. You're going to know exactly what to do. And it's not me. She said, I'm going to give you a roadmap to sponsor other people. And that's absolutely what happened. I remember the first person asking me, can you help me? I was like, yes, I can. I knew I could because I had my stuff from Tanya in my book. And when I say God, I just mean any power of our own understanding. And she told me that we'd embark on a journey where we'd figure out what that was. She started to take me through the steps and I talked a lot about this. So let me tell you what changed is that in the second step, she asked me a question. She said, is God everything or is God nothing? What is your choice to be? And I'm a straight-A student. I know the answer to that. And I was like, God is everything. Thank you. And she said, really? It's so interesting that you'd say that. My sponsor has jokes. And I said, why? And she said, because if God was everything, you wouldn't be screaming in the bathroom of your apartment, and you wouldn't be acting like a lunatic. So if God were everything, you would be free. What do you think? And I was like, you're rude. I said, I guess I would like God to be everything. She said, I can work with that. She had me embark at that moment on an inventory process where I got to inventory the power that I was carrying at that moment, and I got to design an inventory of a power that I would be completely willing to turn my will and my life over to. And it was through that inventory process that I was able to really take a look at all these things I had collected from movies and television and the things that you said and all of this stuff, and I laid it on paper and I took a real look at what was inside of me and what was in my heart. And I was able to start to let go of things that I didn't even care to believe, but for whatever reason, I was carrying them around. Because if I would see you at meetings before that point, I'd be holding your hands and I'd be praying and I'd be like, God's amazing, right? Like, because I wanted that to be the case. But when I walked away from you, I didn't really believe in a power. I didn't believe that this power was taking care of me, and I couldn't understand why I couldn't connect. I couldn't connect to something that I had no idea what it was. For myself and in my heart, I had to get rid of all this stuff that was blocking me. And then she took me through with that power, and I was able to go through the rest of the work with Tanya. I love to talk about amen. So I did all this inventory, months and months of inventory, and she gave me a system to stay free for the rest of my life, and we continue to do inventory in that way today together. And we got to the ninth step. Now, in my sponsorship family, we sponsor in and out of amends, right? Which means that I call Tanya before I go in. I call her the night before, too, and we go over so I don't go off script and say anything weird. And sometimes, right, sometimes I got better at it over the years, and I was able to ad-lib a little bit. But I call Tanya, and then I go in. And so it comes to the day that I'm supposed to make amends to my dad. Now, I've made amends to my dad before because I've been through the steps before, but this is a big deal. My dad is the person I hurt the most in the world. And I was able to describe this the other day. I'll never tell you that my dad gave up on me, but he looked at me different. Even when I came to get sober, even when I had a couple years sober, there was something broken that I had broken in him. And I could see it in his eyes, and all I wanted was for it to be different. And now by this time, I'm helping other people through the book. I know what the book says on amends. What the book says is that I don't get to have any expectations of what happens on the other side. So I call Tanya before I go in, and she's like, you got this. I was like, I got this, let's go. And I go in to sit with my dad, and I think that what's going to happen is the stories that you guys have told me, right? Where the clouds part and he's going to cry, Rod Stewart's going to cry, and we're going to hug, and everything's going to be different because I've done this work and I'm saying these things and I'm ready to do this stuff, right? And I go in. What I didn't tell you too is my dad's got jokes. He's real funny. And he chose this moment to be funny. And so I start reading and I start talking, and I said, he goes, did you forget about the time that you stole my checkbook? And I was like, no, Dad, it's on here. And I'm talking to him, and he says, are you almost done? I'm hungry. And I was like, yeah, I'll be done soon. And so I like do my little snivelly amends, and I try and I say, I ask my questions I'm supposed to ask, or anything you'd like to say to me about behavior, right? What can I do to make this right? All my little questions. And we have lunch because he's hungry. And I go outside and I call Tanya on the street corner, and Tanya is so pumped, right? Because she thinks I'm going to have this great amends story. And she says, "How was it, baby?" And I said, it was okay. And she goes, "What's wrong?" And I'm like crying. And I said, "Well, you just made a lot of jokes and stuff, and it wasn't really what I thought it was going to be." And she said, "You didn't break his heart over an index card. You're not going to fix it over one, honey." Now starts the amends. You made an approach. Now you get to be a daughter to your dad. I said, "Yes, ma'am, what do you want me to do? Because I'll do anything, you know?" And she said, "You're going to be a daughter to your dad now, honey. You're going to show up. He's always going to know where you are. When he needs you, you're going to run over." And what I can tell you is that all these years later, my dad has known where I've slept every single night for the last 18 years. Hotel name, coordinates, location, who I'm with, right? When my dad calls me, I run over. When he moved, I came with on my hands and knees and cleaned his entire house. Whatever I could do to be a daughter to my dad, I used to miss holidays, so I started hosting them. And I remember once I was having people in my tiny little apartment for Thanksgiving, and I had like tables going to the outside. And my dad said, "Can we give you some money?" And I said, "No, Dad, I've got it." And I hosted my entire family for Thanksgiving and all these things. This is years and years and years and years. And I'm doing all this stuff. And Tanya says to me, she said it to me recently. She said, "You know why I've always told you the truth, baby?" I said, "Why?" She said, "Because I always knew you didn't want to die." And I said, "I still don't." And so I did all this stuff, and it comes to be that I'm 12 years sober, and I'm out at an amusement park, and I get a call from my dad, and he's in the hospital. And my dad has never been in the hospital in my entire life. We are very healthy other than this pesky alcoholism thing, right? Like, nobody goes to the hospital. And I'm the baby of three children, and we all live on the same street in Studio City. And so I go, and I get to the hospital. I rush there, and I get in the room, and it's just me and my dad. And I looked at him, and I realized really quickly that we're facing something really scary. My dad has never, like, looked scared, and I said, I realized fast that he's afraid he's going to die. And, you know, what do I do in that moment, right? I'm like, okay, be the woman that Alcoholics Anonymous raised you to be. This isn't about you. This is about him. Show up and be a daughter to your dad. And I'm terrified, right? And I don't know what it feels like, but when you only have one parent, it's really scary to face losing them. And I looked at this, and And I said, "Dad, what do you need me to do?" And I talked to him, and I looked around, and I said, "Where is everybody?" And he said, "I just called you, kid. I wanted to make sure somebody sane and sober was in the room running point for this family on what could be a really tragic situation. And now that you're here, you can call the rest of the family." An amends isn't an "I'm sorry." What I have written in my book is an amends is a restoration. It's restoring the person to the position they were in before I ripped through their life to the best of my ability. And that takes time sometimes. And I had spent all those years becoming the daughter that my dad deserves. If that's the only thing that ever happens, and it's not, because so many magical things have happened over all these years, I will spend the rest of my life trying to pay you guys back. My dad obviously didn't die that day because I get to stalk him now. He said it's a medical miracle. Like, he said that to me the other day. We're facing something similar right now. I got similar news about a year ago today, and I'm just enjoying every single day with my father. And I get to be a daughter to my dad. I get to be a sister to my sisters. I get to be a friend to my friends, a sponsor to my sponsees, and all of these beautiful, magical things. This from the scared little girl that was ready to die, you know. All of these wonderful, magical things have happened, and I am so grateful. Everything I value about myself, everything, was built here on the campus of Alcoholics Anonymous by you incredible, beautiful people. You raised this little girl into the woman that I am today. And I look at myself in the mirror, and there's nothing I'm ashamed of, nothing I'm not proud of. I am so proud of the woman that you've built me into. And what I can tell you is that I passed your work on. And today I get to stand up at the graduations and weddings of so many women that I've worked with over the years, and we have this great fellowship, and we walk shoulder to shoulder through life. If If you are new and you want anything that sounds like what I described, it's available to you, and it's outlined in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we will help you find it. Thank you for letting me share.
Additional Encore audio archive recordings are available at www.12stepTapes.com. We request you not upload this recording to the major free outlets. We are happy to allow free listening on our own site with a subscription service. Contact us on www.12stepTapes.com for more information.